if you, and again, if you fail the test, they can confiscate your car. If you refuse the test, your license is suspended, and you.
Of the Judiciary Committee to order the Subcommittee on Criminal Law and Corrections. Today on our agenda, we have scheduled for a public hearing, possible work session, might add quite likely work session, House Bill 2018, Senate Bill 371, House Bill 2584, House Bill 2623, House Bill 2200, and also House Bill 3167. For the benefit of the witnesses, it is my intention to begin very briefly, because of scheduling considerations. We will open the hearing on House Bill 2584 as our first matter of business, which is the roadblock bill, but simply open it to receive the testimony of the two gentlemen who are approaching the witness table. Then we are going to recess that hearing and move into the second item of business, which will be House Bill 3167, because of some witnesses from out of town on that. We will hopefully resolve House Bill 2623 today, and 2584. We will hear all of those who have come to testify on that measure, because as those who came here last week to give their testimony, they understood, hopefully, why we weren't able to get to that bill, but we will today. So with that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2584. And Greg, learned counsel. Learned counsel, do you want to just give us a brief overview before we are further enlightened by the two distinguished representatives?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2584 deals with sobriety checkpoints. It has two important provisions. First, it authorizes them, and second, it provides for the suspension of driver's licenses for people found to be intoxicated at these checkpoints. Most importantly, it does not provide for criminal penalties such as a conviction for driving under the influence for someone found to be intoxicated at one of the checkpoints. This bill is virtually identical to a bill the House passed last session by a vote of 40-20. It died in the Senate Judiciary Committee without receiving a hearing. The main parts of the bill are sections 1-12 and 22-26. Sections 13-21 are essentially conforming amendments. In addition to the materials that we provided to you last week when this bill was scheduled for a hearing, you have a section-by-section analysis prepared by one of the committee counsel from last session. It deals with what was then House Bill 2008, but since the bills are virtually identical, we've included it so that you could quickly check through to see what the bill is about. There is a fiscal impact statement that says it has a minimal impact.
I'm not dumping on the bill.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Extraordinarily learned counsel, and welcome Representative Burton and Representative Speaker Pro Tem Markham. Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm, for the record, State Representative Mike Burton, District 17, and I really am pleased to be up here with Representative Markham right now, particularly given the fact that the membership on the committee seems to reflect one particular party. I'm going to have to talk to my caucus about this. I do appreciate that you're taking us early like this so we can get on back to the thing. The bill that's before you, as the council mentioned, is a bill very similar to, was exactly like the one which the House of Representatives passed out last session, and we bring it back again with hopes that we can further the issue. I'd like to just point out a couple things of what the intent of this is, and perhaps by way of saying some things that it does not do. And as counsel already pointed out, this does not provide any criminal penalty, so this is a civil remedy for a problem that we have with our roads. The intent here is to try, in the bottom and the final analysis, to get people who may be intoxicated who are driving off the road. And it does so in a couple of ways, and we can show you some statistics as to the effectiveness of roadblocks. Roadblocks are effective in deterring people from driving while intoxicated, or hopefully at least would be a signal to people that if they plan to do that, that they'll have a designated driver. If you look under Section 4 of the bill, you'll see what the requirements are for establishing the roadblocks. And it's clearly indicated in there that it is that they're to be set up so that there is public knowledge that they're going to be in place. That in itself becomes a deterrent, I think, for people who perhaps would drive under intoxication. The other thing that I want to point out is that the bill really, in to some sense, allows a greater degree of police efficiency. While it is a police responsibility, certainly, to try to patrol roads to find individuals who may have an indication of this, in this particular way, they can probably reduce the possibility of accidents and possibly a death by establishing the roadblocks in the way that they do. An individual who is found to have an indication of inebriation or intoxication by the police is then given an option for a breathalyzer, refuses that, then there are certain actions that take place. And effectively, what you're ending up being able to do is get that person off the road with a suspension of driving privileges for 24 hours. This does not take up additional jail space, which is a concern I know that we all have about what we're doing and if we're going to increase some of our law enforcement opportunities, because it simply gets that person off the road, which is the main thing that we want to do. So we think it's an effective way to deal with an issue that's in front of us, and I hope that you'll give the bill favorable consideration.
Thank you, Representative Burton. Are there questions this time? Thank you.
If the Democrats were here, they would ask.
You overwhelmed them, Mike.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Bill Markham from Southwest Oregon, District 46, and I can recall this bill back 2 years ago, and I'm not sure I was in favor of it then. I'm kind of neutral at the moment, but Mike may persuade me on this one, but I'd read some things in the past year about it, some of them somewhat on the humorous side that I thought would be interesting to the committee about roadblocks. And so let me proceed. I'm all for getting the drunks off the road, even if it requires getting everybody else off the road as well. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court has okayed by a vote of 6-3, that police can set up roadblocks and stop every motorist to see if he or she is drunk or not. Never mind the Fourth Amendment, which protects Americans from unreasonable search and seizure. Chief Justice Rehnquist, speaking from the majority of the court, said the state's interest in preventing drunk driving outweighed the intrusion of the motorists, as Mike has indicated earlier, which is fine, I guess, as far as it goes. But what worries me is, where do we go from here? Now, I got a pretty fertile imagination, Mr. Chairman. I can imagine all sorts of good causes that might be served by a few roadblocks along the highway of human rights. Stop me when you think I've gone too far, if you will, please. Imagine you pull up to a roadblock or met by a patrol of estate planners wearing guns, badges, Smokey the Bear hats, checking your insurance program to see you have adequate coverage. Being properly insured is supposedly a good thing in Oregon, if you all recall. Imagine you pull up the roadblock and are met by a patrol of dental hygienists wearing guns, badges, Smokey the Bear hats, checking to make sure you've brushed and flossed your teeth. Promoting dental health is a good thing, too, as we all know. And this goes on a little bit. Imagine you pull up the roadblock and are met by a patrol of mothers wearing guns, badges, and Smokey the Bear hats, checking to see if you've phoned your mother lately. Keeping in touch with your mother, of course, we all know is a good thing. Imagine you pull up a roadblock and are met by a patrol of nutritionists wearing guns, badges, Smokey the Bear hats, checking to see you're eating a balanced diet of fruits, vegetables, cereal, grain, dairy products, meat, fish, chicken, because we all know a balanced diet is a lovely thing for all of us to do, in spite of the fact we don't do it at noon up here in the lounge. And continuing on, imagine you pull up a roadblock and are met by a patrol of therapists wearing guns, badges, Smokey the Bear hats, checking to see if you have an attitude problem. I'm not sure I can get through this, Mr. Chairman. Maintaining the right attitude, of course, is a good thing. And finally, imagine you pull up the roadblock and are met by a patrol of proctologists wearing guns. Now, wait a minute, I haven't finished. They're anticipating. Guns, badges, Smokey the Bear hat, a bear hat, and a rubber glove. Kind of get the idea about intrusion on human rights, huh? Let me say the Oregon Supreme Court strongly suggests that the state constitution would tolerate a non-criminal checkpoint program duly authorized by the legislature. This means that under such a law, suspected drivers could be pulled off the road and have their cars and licenses confiscated, but not subject to criminal prosecution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Markham. We'll try to balance the interests of the state versus the intrusion and privacy rights of our citizens and appreciate those observations.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Burton, you had...
Thank you.
Were there... All right, we will recess the public.
Do we have a copy of his testimony?
Do you want one? We'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 2584, and we will open a... where's my schedule? 3197 is the... 3167. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3167.
Mr. Council? Chair, members of the committee, what House Bill
3167.
3167 would do would add an additional element to Assault 3, which is a Class C felony, which would require that a person recklessly cause physical injury to a person operating a public transit vehicle.
Thank you, Council. Wally Feist, is that correct? Feist? And does Debbie Amundson want to come up at this time? Mr. Marquis, did you also? Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee. I'm Wallace Feist. I'm Secretary Treasurer of the Amalgamated Transit Union, Division 757 in Portland. I'm here to speak in behalf of passage of House Bill 3167. For the last 14 years that I've been associated with this union, we have discovered that there have been numerous assaults on transit operators throughout the state. This problem is not unique to the Portland metropolitan area. We represent members in Lane County and Rogue Valley and Eugene and Medford as well. I brought with me a member of our transit district in Portland, Debbie Amundson, to testify on some experiences that she's had in the past, and we'll be glad to answer any questions you may have when we're through. Debbie?
My name is Debbie Amundson, and I am a member of the Amalgamated Transit Union 757. I was hired on at TriMet in February of 1981. And during the first 5 years, there was different incidents on the bus that made me feel threatened for the safety of myself as well as my passengers on the bus. In September of 1985, I was sexually and physically assaulted on my bus. After that time, I was off work for about 11 months and had to undergo intense psychotherapy counseling to deal with this. I returned to driving then, and on January 16th of this year, I had a person assault me while I was driving down the street at 35 miles an hour with an articulated bus, and had to stop that bus to keep from, after being assaulted, I had to stop that bus quickly to keep from injuring people. The person was arrested. He was taken to jail and did not appear for his hearings. There's a lot of, every day when I go to work, I wonder if, you know, if something's going to happen. It's getting real dangerous out there for drivers. And I'd be glad to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of these witnesses?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sinceri.
What is the incidence of assaults? In other words, you obviously have a serious case here, but, I mean, is this something that's common? Does it happen a lot?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sinceri, the tracking mechanism that most properties use, I don't believe is accurate. As a union representative, I deal with this on a weekly basis, as early as last Saturday evening, the most recent case. I don't think that this is something that's published for public information, because what happens is the writing or public that we deal with, oftentimes those factions say, hey, it's a wide open ball game out there. There's no defense for these people. There's no police protection, or it's limited in scope. We don't have any accurate numbers. I can only attest to the fact that if I were to request information from the properties that we represent, that would be an estimation of what happens on a weekly basis.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bryan.
Could you refresh me, my memory? At last session, didn't we, what did we do with regard to protection of mass transit drivers? Didn't we do something? Do you remember?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, we introduced legislation on a similar piece of legislation to introduce legislation to make this a Class C felony. And I believe that came out of committee at that time, was voted on the floor, then ultimately vetoed by the governor at the time.
Hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Marquis, you have some additional information on that point?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Marquis, representing Amalgamated Transit Union. To answer Representative Bryan's question, Amalgamated Transit Union did introduce a piece of legislation like this last session. It was put together with another piece of legislation sponsored by Representative Minnis, which if some of you may recall was the Police Officers Bill of Rights Bill. And those two pieces of legislation became one and were sent to the governor, and the governor vetoed the package. Our information from the governor's office was that it was vetoed as a result of other things contained in the bill, not this provision.
That's why it was so familiar. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Marquis, if you could remain there just briefly. Council, maybe this is an appropriate time to... We have in the bill the language, operating a public transit vehicle. Is that defined in the statute, what precisely we're talking about? Public transit vehicles.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Robinson, I believe that a transit vehicle is defined in the mass transit section of the statute, although I'd have to go back and check that to be absolutely certain.
But not in the criminal code.
Not in the criminal code, no.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes.
Representative Mason.
You defined the offense as recklessly causes physical injury to another while the person's in control of operating a public transit vehicle. The rest of the statute speaks in terms of either serious physical injury using a deadly weapon, serious physical injury under circumstances manufacturing extreme indifference, or physical injury by deadly weapon under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to value of human life. And for the life of me, I can't tell the difference between... Oh, okay.
There is?
It's the difference between
deadly and dangerous. Well, it's deadly or dangerous. I can't tell between A and C, to be very frank.
Because one, Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, one serious physical injury primarily, and one is physical injury. And what the prosecutorial burden for serious physical injury... And we're going to hear testimony on this actually from another witness on a similar bill. You have to be pretty much in the hospital. If you have a broken leg is not considered serious physical injury. So the difference is the level of injury that needs to occur in order to get bump you up from assault 4 to assault 3.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative
In terms of
Mason.
The difference between B and B.
Jim Marquis again. I believe that what we're trying to say in this is that we believe that the danger to the public, because there are a lot of folks on these buses, is so great, in addition to the danger to the driver, that any physical injury, regardless of the seriousness of that injury, ought to be treated as a felony in these cases.
One additional question, just so we'll least I'll have some understanding or better understanding. When you talk about the person is in control of or operating, down on the mall, once in a while you see the TriMet small vehicle, I guess, and maybe a scheduler or whatever they are. I'm not sure what the capacity is of the folks in the sedans that get out and perhaps tell the drivers that they're ahead of schedule or on schedule or whatever their mission is. Do they have any control capacity? Would they be reached by this statute if they were assaulted?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Markey again. I believe that they would under the way we've developed the language. And when we put in control of, it would be our contention that any time a driver is on duty, he is in control of the bus. If he were on the mall, not actually operating the bus, yes, he would be subject to the statute.
I appreciate that. I'm also, I think, talking about some supervisory personnel, perhaps.
I don't believe they would be
covered, Mr.
Chairman.
They aren't controlling the...
No. Our concern, and the reason that we used the language, or in control, was that we didn't want to allow someone to raise the defense that this person wasn't actually behind the driver's driving wheel at the time, and therefore this statute didn't apply. We didn't want them to have that defense.
Do you need to be behind the wheel at the time
of
the assault in order? I mean, could you be perhaps maybe from time to time you have passengers, you need to go counsel about their behavior a few seats behind you, and maybe you've had on occasion, I don't know, to get up from your seat and go back and say, hey, you got to knock it off or something, or you're collecting a fare or something, and somebody says, I don't like your attitude, and assaults you. Wouldn't that, I mean, you don't have to be in your seat to be.
My point was, Mr. Chairman, that if we didn't use the word in control of,
okay,
if we only talked to
or
while operating a bus, then I believe you'd have to be behind the wheel, and that's why the word control or in control of is there.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3167? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3167, open a work session on House Bill 3167. Representative Bryan.
Chair, I'd move House Bill 3167 in full committee due pass.
I'll receive that in just a moment. Counsel, you had something you wanted to add prior to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm in the process of having copied for you a copy of ORS 166-115, which is currently the crime of interfering with public transportation. What that crime is, it's a Class A misdemeanor, and it basically is a step under this, which is if you are harassing a bus driver or annoying them or doing a person who is also in control or operating a bus, that you would be guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. I would encourage the committee to look at the language in that bill in terms of how it defines public transportation and public bodies so that they are consistent, given the fact that this statute is already on the books and that this proposed amendment it very much fits into the scheme that if you cause injury that's greater than harassing them or offensive physical contact, because you are going from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony, that the language be consistent. I think that the intent of the bill in talking about a public transit vehicle is identical. Mass transit is defined, but not in the criminal code. I could not find another definition of a bus driver. But I think that the language of public transit vehicle is identical to certainly what the intent of what Mr. Markey was talking about, and given the fact that I see, if I was a prosecutor and I got a bus case and I was trying to figure out how to charge it, I would look at this statute and I would look at this statute if passed, and I think it would be advisable to have the same terminology describing the operator of a public transit vehicle.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Mason.
There's an interesting statute that the committee might want to consider. That's ORS 164-365. And that's a statute we've had a lot of problems with, and that says it's criminal mischief in the first degree, but under subparagraph sub 1, sub D, and criminal mischief in the first degree is a Class C felony. It says, with the properties of a public utility, telecommunications utility, or public transportation facility used in direct service to the public. Interestingly enough, they've had the same definitional problems there with that statute vis-a-vis public transport. Basically, what that statute says is if you spray on the side of a TriMet bus shelter, it's a Class C felony, as opposed to spraying on the side of someone's house or a building. And it makes for an interesting kind of statutory scheme. I think the bill's an excellent bill, especially when it comes to the person who's operating the vehicle. And I think that's the best rationale, is when the person's operating the vehicle. I'm a little uncomfortable when they're not operating the vehicle. We're going to upgrade a felony here, and I think you need a rationale for that. And the reason why I'm going to quibble a little bit is I see a very valid rationale for making it a Class C felony to injure someone while they're operating a vehicle. If they're not operating the vehicle, then they're just, with all due respect to the fact that their employment, then I don't think it makes sense to make it a Class C felony for, again, I don't want to in any way show disrespect to members of the profession, but if to use Representative Chairman Miller's example, if you attack the supervisor standing on the mall, that's a crime, and I think should be prosecuted as the regular crime. But the attack of the supervisor doesn't endanger the 20 people behind you in the bus. I don't think they're the same situation. And interestingly enough, I think that in the other hypothetical for the speaker and for the chairman, and this might be something we want to discuss, that if you stop the bus and you put the brakes on and you go back and you talk to whatever appellation we want to use on this character in the back of the bus, sleazeball, in the back, then the bus, there's no danger to the public. But if he's attacking you when you're operating the bus, that's the situation I think merits the felony. I don't know what the rest of the committee thinks.
Mr. Chair.
Well, let me just respond briefly. I think if I understood Mr. Marquis right and the witnesses, that the supervisor wasn't captured by this control phrase. It was the operator who was in the bus and kind of control of the bus, not necessarily sitting in the chair driving, perhaps stopped, maybe even standing up and perhaps going back and visiting with a unruly passenger who kind of in the course of the operation, but I think you didn't want to get hung up on the fact that the operator wasn't actually operating at the moment of the assault, would still be subject to this. Not the supervisor on the mall, however. So that may not change your...
Well, no, it's something we should discuss because sure. I think there's some... The gravamen of the bill is the fact the guy's operating a bus and other people's lives are in danger. So then you're saying, well, if the driver saw fit to stop the bus and to take the other people's life of danger, does his protection suddenly diminish as he gets out of his driver's seat? You probably could argue that it shouldn't diminish as he or she gets out of the driver's seat to go to the back to take care of this,
Representative Bryan and Representative Baum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it would help if we said recklessly causes physical injury to an operator of public transportation while such person is in control of or operating the vehicle. So we've narrowed it to make sure we don't have the supervisor involved. But to me, if the driver or operator gets up and goes back and he's still on the bus and there's 20 people on the bus and an assault occurs in that close proximity to others, there is an aggravating factor present. I agree if he's off the bus, that's a different thing. But if he's on that bus in close proximity, I think there is a danger to the public that's different than supervisor standing outside.
Representative Baum.
Representative Bryan's correct. We have to, and Representative Mason too, we have to confine it. If a woman or a man stops a bus and walks back to deal with the sleazeball in the back, sleazeball assaults and her while she's walking back there or something, they ought to be the same penalty for attacking him in the seat. Because he's stopping the bus, he's going back. It's not safe to stop buses, outside of their normal stop-and-go routine. So if we can draft something to put language in there.
Put it in the vehicle.
The language?
Additional comments? Representative Johnson?
I'm just curious, what for, you know, slugging somebody in the back of the head, what is the current penalty if they're not driving a bus? Under current law, I mean, if, what is the guilty person here subject to if we don't pass this bill?
Depends on what you hit him with. Depends on what you hit him with and how bad the injury is.
And whether it's with extreme indifference for life.
It could be anything from it could be, I mean, if you hit him with a newspaper.
Coke bottle, we back to Coke bottle?
He's stuck on Coke bottle. If you hit him with a newspaper, it would probably be, well, I think if you hit him with a newspaper while they were driving the bus, then that statute that I just copied for you would probably come into play, interfering with the public transportation. That'd be a Class A misdemeanor, or an assault 4, which would be a Class A misdemeanor. It could be if they distracted them while they were driving, so it was recklessly endangering, it would be a Class A misdemeanor. I suppose.
What if we just added the word and
harassment's
the word or?
Class A misdemeanor, I think, too. And then at that point, once you do some sort of injury, or what you use can cause some damage, like a Coke bottle.
Participating should, in fact, aggravate the injury in and of itself. I can see some rationale in terms of the inability to defend oneself, to flee, you know, with other people present.
Representative Mason has a good point, but I don't know whether it's easy to redefine a third or in between option. I have no problem with this bill. I mean, it's good for anti-gang things, I guess. I don't have very many of those in the Grand or Wallowa, but, you know, we'll do something good for Portland here. Representative Mason thinks it's a good idea for his folks.
Further comments? Is there a motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me try one more.
Representative Mason?
Just a suggestion, and I'd like to hear from the committee on perhaps resolving this definitional problem that we've come upon, and that is how broad the current definition of physical injury is and how narrow the current definition of serious physical injury is. I don't know whether or not the committee wants to tackle that, but I can live with a bill if we moved the actually present amendment.
Not yet.
Not yet.
No.
With the actually present amendment, the reason I can live with the bill is that there is something about more than one person in an assault which is vicious and cowardly, and Representative Baum, with all due respect, I think you might find this bill.
I'm talking about the ganging up on people.
Yeah, well, you might find this bill has a little more application over in your area than you want.
Well, it's usually outside the barn. There's two or three guys.
Yeah,
well,
that's my
one.
Point. I don't think this can be confined to Portland here.
No, but I don't think the Justice Department is finding its motivation from the cowboy bar, Mutter Buck Room. But they might.
Yeah.
All right. Did you want to move the actually present language?
I would, and I hope our proponent is still here so she can correct me if I don't state it properly. The line on line 12, it should read, or words to that effect, while being aided by another person, quote, actually present, actually present, comma, intentionally or knowingly causes physical injury to another. And let me ask her a real quick lawyer's question. Are intentionally and knowingly the terms you want as opposed to recklessly? Are those the terms you want?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. So I'd move that amendment.
Representative Vice Chair Honorable Professor Mason moves in line 12. After the word person, insert the words actually present before the word intentionally. Is there a discussion of the motion? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, it is adopted. Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Bryan.
Does the phrase another person include persons as well? It automatically, you know, it says while being aided by another person intentionally, or actually present person,
yes,
or persons? Is it, does it,
yes,
say it?
Mr. Lowell? Chairman.
Representative Sunseri.
I still have a question with the idea that the high school battle that goes on after the football game, and you've got somebody that holds somebody's coat or a group of people standing around watching what's going on, are we increasing something here that could be a detriment to...
detriment fighting?
No. Well,
I mean, I understand that there's a problem here that needs to be dealt with, but I'm concerned about the sweeping scope of what we're doing.
Can I answer that?
Representative Mason.
I can think of a specific situation where there was an assault that occurred and 11 other people stood around and didn't do anything about it, who were under duty to do something about it and should have done something about it, that it should become under this particular type of statute.
That's a different situation, isn't it? I mean, standing around watching and you should have done something rather than participating is
Jefferson Mason, what was that?
Different.
What was that situation?
Chair, can I ask him that question?
Go right ahead.
Just briefly describe the facts. Just maybe hit
policemen
the...
We have a 12-member...
All on TV, the videotape. Okay.
Pursued, they essentially pursued in this and participated in the assault.
Okay.
I was thinking of the 12-member Judiciary Committee. Yes.
Chairman, your counsel requested I reapproach the bench. I think on this
counsel.
Question... Go ahead.
You want to answer Representative Sinceri's question?
Right. Chair, Representative Sinceri, I think the difference is... the people that are just standing watching aren't aiding the person who's committing the assault, so they wouldn't be covered by the statute, and they also wouldn't be covered... as an aider and abettor, because as an aider and abettor, you have to do something to actually promote, facilitate, or encourage the assault. So that's, they would never be included. That's also true if they witnessed a robbery.
How about the holding of the coat? Is that...
The holding of the
coat? If one person's holding the other person while the other person's being
hit. No, holding... Please hold my coat while assault this person.
No, that's not going to be aiding the person. There's no. I can't imagine that the person would be convicted of aiding. In fact, a recent case that discussed what your liability is when you're just watching is State versus Holloway, and it was a gang shooting case out of Portland. And a person in the back of the truck from which the shots were fired, those persons were not guilty as aiders and abettors in a gang drive-by shooting case. So the court's real clear about what you have to do, and you have to do something. You have to actively do something.
Okay.
What if you, if I might, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, Representative Mason.
What if you serve as a barrier to the victim's escape?
That would, Chairman, Representative Mason, that would definitely, I think, that's one of the things I was talking about. When you prevent the person from escaping and being able to defend themselves, then you're aiding the person who's assaulting them, and I think that should be covered.
And what if you, prior to the assault, had engaged in pursuit of the victim with the other assaulters?
Arrested, beating.
Chairman, Representative Mason, I think I agree also that should be, that person should be covered, because it's the idea of you're tracking the prey down and grabbing them to facilitate the assault. So those things should be covered.
Good bill.
Further questions?
Got the record on that one.
Representative Sinceri, you're comfortable now. Thank you.
I'm still here.
All right. Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
I've been comfortable since January.
I think there wasn't.
No, I think Representative Bryan asked a question before Representative Mason had an opportunity to make the motion. I believe that's correct.
I made the motion on the amendment. I have nothing. I made the motion.
That's my recollection. Did you want to try to?
I'll send move the bill to the full. Do pass as amended.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Moves House Bill 2018 as amended to the full committee with do pass recommendation. Further discussion. Hearing none. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Baum.
Yes.
Representative Bryan.
Aye.
Representative Johnson. Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Parks.
Aye.
Representative Sinceri.
Aye.
Chair Miller.
Votes aye. Bill is passed to the full committee. Close the public hearing, or the work session, excuse me, on House Bill 2018. Council, any more
two quick ones.
Simple measures?
So much for my credibility on that.
Sure.
Statement.
Senate Bill
371. And then we have one work session.
All right. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 371. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 371 A, engrossed, comes to the committee at the request of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I would describe it as a housekeeping measure. Currently, the board has the ability to suspend parolees and do other things, but that jurisdiction was not extended to individuals on post-prison supervision in light of the changes that were made last session with the implementation of sentencing guidelines and persons being placed on post-prison supervision rather than parole. What this bill does is extend that power to allow them to arrest and detain post-prison supervision violators. Not a lot to it, but then again,
well,
I've said that
be
before
careful
today.
When you say that, Mr. Fotz.
Thank you.
We've only taken an hour on the simple ones. So.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Vern Fotz. I'm chairman of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And I'm here on House Bill 371. I think counsel has explained it very well. We have the authority to suspend parole on parole violators, but when sentencing guidelines was passed, we overlooked the necessity of being able to suspend and detain, that is, arrest and detain persons under post-prison supervision, and we find that to be a very necessary activity, particularly on those who are on post-prison supervision and abscond supervision and leave the state. We can't issue warrants for their arrest and return. We can't suspend the running of the sentence. And it's conceivable, given that the period of post-prison supervision for some of these folks is a year or 2 years, that that will be eaten up in the time that they're out of state on abscond status. They would then never serve any period of supervision here in Oregon. So what we have here is, in fact, a housekeeping measure that that closes this loophole for us, gives us the same authority for people under post-prison supervision as we have for persons under parole.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you again. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 371? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 371, open a work session on Senate Bill 371.
Ready to go.
Committee members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bryan.
I'd move Senate Bill 371A engrossed to the full committee to pass.
Thank you. Representative Bryan moves Senate Bill 371 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Baum?
Yes.
Representative Bryan?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Mason? Representative Parks?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri?
Aye.
Chair Miller?
Votes aye. Senate Bill 371 is passed to the full committee. Close the work session on Senate Bill 371.
Oh, I'll do that.
Is that all right?
You want to, are you going to carry this?
Yeah.
Do you want to assign a carrier to the other? Is it a gang bill?
Think about that.
It's been amazing to carry a gang bill. Gangbusters.
Open a work session. House Bill 2200. Counsel, would you refresh our memories on that, please?
I will. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2200 was introduced at the request of the Department of Corrections and would give them authority to dispose of property seized during search and arrest of suspected parole and post-prison supervision violators. Currently, they have the ability to seize the property. They do not have the ability to dispose of it. It is a pretty technical bill in that they would now just have the ability to get rid of it as well. There were some amendments proposed, and Mr. Van Valkenburg is here to explain those briefly, and they have been provided to you.
They are
proposed amendments to 2200 submitted by the Department of Corrections, and they should have been they should be on the with your packet for today, unless I forgot to just hand them out.
I don't have any amendments. Maybe someone else does.
He's got more. That's fine, we seem to have one.
All right. Ms. Flossen, Mr. Van Valkenburg, you want to
tell us about Chairman Miller, please? Members of the committee. We originally met on this bill some weeks ago, and some members of the committee had expressed some concerns. We went back, Ms. Clausen and I, to work on some of those concerns, touch bases with Representatives Parks and Baum, and believe that we've addressed any concerns the committee had expressed at the time. These proposed amendments would take out the definition forfeited goods that was never intended to be in the statute. Or the bill is proposed, deal with the items that parole officers generally deal with, items which are in violation of conditions of parole or post-prison supervision, or other items which are criminally possessed. In addition to that, there, as a term of art, in the BPST, the Board of Police Standards and Training Statutes, there's a definition for adult parole and probation officers. We intended that that language be paralleled in this bill, and most of the amendments relate to that. The final amendment that we're proposing deals with the disposition of any net proceeds which may come from a sale. There was, I think, Representative Brian at one point some weeks ago expressed some concern concerning where that money might go. We've just added in that it go to the general fund if any proceeds were to be derived from disposition. It is the department's understanding that that would be an unlikely scenario in any case that they would be having that occur. But those are the purposes of the amendments.
Thank you very much. questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you. I appreciate the amendments. in line 15, my notes indicate we also discussed a couple things where, like, where it says the clear proceeds. I think we know what the intent is. Has that phrase been used in other recovery areas in the statutes as to what clear proceeds are?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan.
Versus net. You know.
Yeah. That language comes from ORS 133.623, which are the existing disposition statutes which are contained in the arrest section in the criminal code.
And, Mr. Chair, second question.
Representative Bryan.
I don't know if there's any consensus on this, but I had noted the clear proceeds, if any, after reimbursing reasonable cost of the DLC. Did you purposely not get into that, or is that taken care of in the phrase clear proceeds, or what?
I think it's inherent in the language that's used. Primarily, what I anticipate the department doing is in a situation where they actually want to dispose of property, they're going to contract with the Department of General Services to perform that function. And there's some language in the bill to allow them to enter into these contracts to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sunseri.
We may have covered this ground last time we discussed this bill, but do we have a definition of dispose? Line one says they can hold and dispose of the contraband or the unclaimed goods.
Representative Sunseri, Mr. Chairman, I think in Section 2 of the bill, under Subsection 2, there is language, may order the sale, destruction, or other disposition. I think it's leads it up to the discretion of the department how it's properly disposed of.
As to what would be destroyed or what would be sold?
Yes.
A question to follow that then, what prevents confiscation of unnecessary items for sale? Or to be sold?
Representative Sunseri, Mr. Chairman, there's a process which is set out on page 2 of the bill which echoes or parallels the existing statutes in ORS Chapter 133, which provides due process procedures for those claimants who might claim a right to property that may have been seized. The primary function that corrections performs is when the parole officers go out, find a violation, seize property pursuant thereto, that property will be held for local law enforcement or be held for the parole board to make determination of whether or not an actual condition was violated. When that's through, If local law enforcement doesn't need it for purposes of criminal prosecution, then the hearings officer of the Department of Correction will make a determination of where and how the property may be disposed of. Did you want to address that?
Well, I was just going to say it's also covered here that that's the only property we would seize.
In Section 1 of the bill as well, the additional amendment discusses the types of goods which are primarily seized. And these are things, drugs, weapons, drug paraphernalia, as I understand it. Anything else, Ms. Clausen?
Well, excuse me. I don't think that this is a television mentality, but I have talked with people who've been in this situation who have been visited by some of these folks, and some things that were their personal belongings were picked up and taken along the way that didn't have anything to do with anything. And my concern is, how do we prevent that kind of thing?
Okay. Do you want to address that?
And subsequently never received their personal property back.
Okay. Well, as I understand it, Representative Sensari, Mr. Chairman, the bill as drafted allows several procedures for return of goods. First one, there's a summary procedure at the scene where the seizing officer can make the determination based upon a presentation of proof, which satisfies the officer that this belongs to another person and shouldn't be seized. There's the first mechanism. Secondly, the situation where the parole board makes a determination that the possession of the property did not, in fact, constitute a violation of the conditions of parole or post-prison supervision, the board at that point would be constrained to not find a violation. The hearings officer's order, which would order a disposition of the goods, would not be upheld, in essence. And the department wouldn't, at this point, have any interest in continuing the possession of the property or disposing of it. It would be returned to the suspected violator if no violation were found by the board. Now, in the third case, where other individuals make a claim of right to the same property, the process of notice of the hearing and eventually judicial review are all provided in the statute and echo, in essence, the due process procedures which are found in the arrest statutes. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Counsel, you want to add to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sinceri, I would also just point out that by taking out the language forfeited goods and inserting things otherwise criminally possessed or possessed in violation of parole or post-prison supervision, that's significantly narrower. And unless the officer could look at it and readily identify it as being a hot television, I don't think that they would be able to seize it at that point. And so by changing the language, they have narrowed the field of things that could conceivably be taken at that time to what I think to address the committee's concerns and to avoid, I think, inappropriate seizures.
Thank you, counsel. Further questions? Yes, Representative Baum.
My recollection is that under subsection 2, line 9, maybe you already talked about this in my absence, but it says make a written list of things seized. They give that to the officer. Didn't we talk about and indicating that they were going to have some and rights to challenge the seizure of it or anything, or right to contest? Is that anything, is that part of the amendments, or should the written list of things also have a little notice we always put on things, we hand them to people about you have the right to contest this? And, I mean, did we talk about that as a committee last time? I thought we had. I don't see these reflected in this amendments. I mean, is that a major procedural problem to have a little two-liner down there that, you know, and you have a right to contest this by filing a notice here and there and everywhere?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Baum, I don't think that would be a problem at all. In fact, I have some recollection that we discussed that in some fashion, and that could be done actually by rule of the Department of Corrections.
We could just
presently, right now, the Department of Corrections only performs consent searches in these cases, which the committee may not have been aware of. We could provide by rule that notice be given. We'll need to flesh this out as far as procedures for the officers to follow by rule.
You can do how we can just require that you put some rights to contest the seizure on there, and you can promulgate that by rule about how you actually do that. That's not a problem. That way we represent Park's constituents who are wrongfully attacked and have access to
their allegiance to
the procedures. Same with Representative Mason. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Baum.
Anything more I can do for you, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you can go back out.
further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are in work session.
Well,
yes.
Hey, let's move the. I move the proposed amendments to House Bill 2200, excuse me, submitted by the Oregon Department of Corrections.
Representative Baum moves the amendments proposed or indicated to be submitted by the Oregon Department of Corrections to House Bill 2200 with the further amendment that a notice
that
be provided
that
the.
Right. On line 9, after the word seize, put in there, and rights to contest seizure.
Discussion of the amendments. Is there objection to the amendments? Hearing none, they are adopted. Is there a motion on the bill as amended? Representative Baum moves House Bill 2200 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Baum?
Yes.
Representative Bryan?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Parks?
Aye.
Representative Cesari?
Aye.
Chair Miller?
Votes aye. House Bill 2200 is passed to the full committee. Close the work session. House Bill 2200. Open a... Thank you, Ms. Clausen and Mr. Van Valkenburg. Open a work session. Thank you, Council.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair.
On House Bill 2584, reopen the public hearing. House Bill 2584. Roadblocks. We had initial testimony from Representatives Markham and Burton. And wanted to remind you that this bill is a civil matter, and we want to make sure it remains that way, and that's one of the reasons it is before this criminal law committee, because we would certainly be aware of things that got dangerously close to becoming criminal violations and want to make sure that didn't happen. That's people had some concern as to why would this bill be here. That's certainly one of the reasons. The other thing, I think, is that we've been dealing with drug and alcohol problems in this particular committee. It makes sense that this bill come before us. And as a matter of course, this bill will, assuming it makes it past this subcommittee, will be considered by the entire committee. And so at one point or another, we will all have the opportunity to make a judgment on House Bill 2584. With that, I would invite Rosanna Creighton. And Extraordinarily Learned Counsel, we welcome you back.
Thank you.
Did we vote on that promotion?
The Extraordinary? We probably shouldn't. Roseanne.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rosanna Creighton, Executive Director of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon, and I am here to address House Bill 2584, a bill introduced at our request by Senator Paul Phillips and Representatives Mike Burton, Delna Jones, and Kevin Mannix. It is also co-sponsored by 10 senators and 21 representatives. Attached to my presentation, I have some news articles for you. One is Wednesday, June 20th, 1990, editorial in the Oregonian. It was a result of an editorial after the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that it was not against the U.S. Constitution to have sobriety checkpoints. This editorial, just briefly, just a section of it says, the U.S. Supreme Court has given Oregon good reason to rethink its ban on police checkpoints for catching drunken drivers. Safeguards for individuals are important. However, there's still the matter of public safety, public's right to safety. Fortunately, there's a way to change Oregon law short of amending the Oregon Constitution. The Oregon Supreme Court strongly suggested that the state constitution would tolerate a non-criminal checkpoint program duly authorized by the legislature, and then the editorial goes on to suggest that we introduce the bill, which we did. Last week I testified on a bill, House Bill 2623, and some folks thought I spoke for over 14 minutes. I timed myself. It was around 7. So just to please everybody, I will not testify any further today. I am not an expert on DUII issues, and I yield this testimony and hearing to those who are. Are there any questions?
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barbara Stoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Barbara Stoffler, the legislative chair for Oregon Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I have, 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, I took my testimony for the record into your office, and perhaps you have it in your folders. If there is a time constraint, Mr. Chair, I will not read the testimony. It should take about 1 minute, it's all. If there's a problem with that, I'll just let you read it yourself.
All right. Perhaps if you could summarize your testimony, that'd be helpful and be available for questions.
For the record, each year, some 1.8 million arrests are made for drunken driving in this country. In Oregon alone, a total of 27,997 arrests were made last year. However, it is estimated that for each arrest, anywhere from 300 to 2,000 trips are made undetected by drunken drivers. That means it's not worded very well, but drunken drivers may drive 300 to 2,000 trips without being detected. An intoxicated driver may travel as much as 5,000 miles impaired by alcohol and or other drugs, equivalent to a coast-to-coast trip before being stopped for a DUII offense. It is small wonder, then, that impaired drivers think they can do so with impunity. Prevention and deterrence of driving after drinking or taking drugs require efforts on many fronts, including education of the public about the risk involved. And I think that to emphasize the deterrence effect of the roadblocks is what this...